Welcome to Cardiovascular Matters. Whether you are looking for answers for yourself or someone you love, we are here to give you the best information available. Each week, the founder of Cardiovascular Institute of the South, Dr. Craig Walker, and medical device sales veteran, Terry Roberts, discuss the causes, symptoms, treatment, and prevention of health-related issues stemming from cardiovascular disease. Now here's your hosts, Dr. Craig Walker and Terry Roberts.
Hello everyone, welcome to the very first Cardiovascular Matters. I'm your host, Terry Roberts. I spent 35 years in medical device sales. Every day I was in hospitals, operating rooms, physicians' offices, and cath labs. And while I was in the field, I'd hear patients and their families discussing medical issues. I'd hear them say things like, "I don't understand what the doctor said," or "I can't remember what the doctor said." This need for knowledge and understanding led to the formation of Cardiovascular Matters. I'm partnering with my good friend, Dr. Craig Walker, who will be featured in the podcast. Dr. Walker is from Houma, Louisiana. He is a world-renowned cardiologist with 40 years of experience. His CV is as thick as a book. Here are just a few highlights. Let me read them. Dr. Walker is board certified in internal medicine, cardiovascular disease, and interventional cardiology. He is also a clinical professor of medicine at both Tulane and LSU schools of medicine. Dr. Walker is founder and chairman of Cardiovascular Institute of the South, which is one of the largest cardiology practices in the world. Dr. Walker also founded Cardiovascular Horizons Meeting, which is an educational meeting, and it's the largest of its kind that features cardiovascular medicine and peripheral vascular disease. This year marks his 25th anniversary. Dr. Walker is clinical editor and board member of Global Vascular Digest and a clinical editor for Vascular Disease Management. Dr. Walker was also elected top 10 young Americans by the United States JC organization. Dr. Walker is also my good friend, and we are lucky to have him provide information and answers on this podcast. So with that, I'd like to welcome you to the first episode, and our topic today is going to be on varicose veins. I'm going to turn this over to Dr. Walker and let him begin, and then I'll come in with some questions as we get started. Dr. Walker?
Thank you, Terry. I'm very happy to be here with this podcast and happy to start with the idea about varicose veins, one of the many vein disorders that occur. I'm particularly happy because this is such a prevalent disease, and yet it is misunderstood, misdiagnosed, and often not diagnosed. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, the incidence of venous disease is higher than the incidence of coronary artery disease, structural heart disease, congestive heart failure, stroke, and cancer all put together. It is very common. Perhaps as many as 50 million people in America will have evidence of venous disorders. Now, the most common of the significant venous disorders is venous insufficiency and venous varicosities, which accompany this. Now, this has probably gotten more attention than most forms of vein disorders in a large manner just because of the cosmetic implications of it. Certainly, when people see big varicose veins, they go, "Gee whiz, these are ugly. I would like to get rid of these." But it's a much bigger problem than just that. Because when we have vein insufficiency, it means a vein is not working right. And so the purpose of a vein is to carry blood back to the heart so that it can be recirculated throughout the body. When William Harvey described circulation, the base word was circle. And it means our blood just keeps going in a circle. It is pumped by the heart via arteries under high pressure, and it goes to the capillaries. At the level of the capillaries, it gives off oxygen and nutrients. And then on the backside of the capillaries, it picks up the waste products and the deoxygenated blood. And then it returns that back to the heart. in order to recirculate, reoxygenate, and repopulate itself with nutrients. And this process goes on constantly in our bodies. Now, when veins don't work well, it's a problem. Now, I'm a gardener, and I think of veins like drainage to a garden. Arterial flow is like the watering of a garden, which is certainly very important. But if we don't drain a garden, what happens? Water builds up. And with venous disease, what we see is a backup of pressures in the legs, and often we see leg swelling. Later on, we may see varicose veins. This can be problematic and can even lead to skin ulcerations of the lower extremities. And these skin ulcerations are a huge problem. In the United States, they're one of the most expensive, most costly diagnosis-related groups that Medicare has to pay for, because often these patients may have large venous ulcers for in excess of 3 decades. I've seen that quite often, and often these are simply misdiagnosed up until that point. Now, whenever we see swollen legs, historically we were taught medical school to think about heart failure, and certainly heart failure can lead to swollen legs if there's right-sided heart failure. But overwhelmingly, the most common cause of a swollen leg or of an edematous leg is venous insufficiency. And what causes venous insufficiency is a loss of valve function in the veins. So arterial blood flow is very easy to understand. The heart puts tremendous pressure into the tubes that we call arteries, and that blood gets pushed wherever it needs to go. But vein flow is more complex. Veins have to return blood against gravity back to our heart. And there are only 3 real factors that help it to do that. One factor is there's a little bit pressure left when blood goes from arteries into veins, and that helps push the blood just a little bit. That is called vis a tergo. It's a Latin word, which means push from behind. Secondly, when our heart relaxes and when we take in deep breaths, there is a negative pressure inside of our chest, and that helps to pull the blood up to some degree. But for the most part, when we're upright, what helps venous blood return is the calf muscle squeezes around veins, squeezing blood up a little further, and there are valves in the veins. And those valves stop the blood from simply running back down with gravity back down the legs. Now, in venous insufficiency, and this is what causes venous varicosities, those valves start to dysfunction. And blood that should be returning to the heart simply runs right back down to the legs, and that's problematic. It's problematic because it raises the pressures in the legs, and that's what can ultimately lead to venous ulcerations. That's what causes swelling of the legs. But it also, over time, could cause other problems. It often causes numbness, tingling, what many people have thought was simply neuropathy, burning, cramping legs at night. Those are all symptoms of vein insufficiency. Now, when we see a large vein under the skin, we call those venous varicosities. These are veins where the valves have ceased to function and they've gotten much bigger because of vein hypertension, so that little valve in the center can no longer stop the blood from moving in the wrong direction. So blood is still coming up the deep veins, which run down near our bones. Those are the superhighways of venous flow. But the veins running right under our skin, the superficial veins, if they're insufficient or if their valves leak, then that blood, when it gets up to certain points where those veins tie into the deep veins, that blood runs right back down to the legs, further pressurizing the legs. And that's what causes the symptoms. Now, this is a real disorder. This is not just a cosmetic problem. And in fact, the treatment of this is covered by most insurances if people have symptoms like I've mentioned before. But it doesn't mean everyone needs to have an interventional treatment. The treatments are many and they're good. But the first treatments that we use are simple. One of those is we ask people to lose weight if they're overweight. Second, we ask them to walk because walking helps to build up the calf muscle. As I've mentioned, it behaves in many ways like the heart does, pumping arterial blood. It helps to pump venous blood. Thirdly, we ask people to elevate the legs above the level of their heart. Well, when they do this, gravity helps venous flow. And it's not how often, it's not how long they do that. It's how often they do this. You know, just for a few seconds, every hour or so, can really help to decompress the pressures in the legs. And then, of course, the most common thing which is used are compression hose. Now, compression hose, certainly you have to get them on. These help to squeeze the leg. They sort of behave like the calf pump behaves in keeping these vessels constricted, helping the flow return back to the heart. And certainly these measures are often helpful and may indeed not only treat a patient's symptoms, but may help to decrease the likelihood of the vein insufficiency getting worse. So certainly we always start with conservative measures. We try to get walking going, leg elevation, calf pump exercises, and we do these measures. But many patients need more than that because in particular, each night they notice that their legs are very swollen. And in the morning, their legs are no longer swollen. Why is that? Well, they're laying flat and they're not fighting gravity, trying to get that blood to go against gravity returning to the heart. Gravity is neutral at that point. So one of the first symptoms that you may have vein insufficiency is that you notice at the end of the day, your legs are swollen. And in the morning, that swelling is gone or is much less than it was before. Obviously, if you look at your legs and you see big varicose veins, or if you push with your finger against the bone on your lower leg and it leaves a big indentation, that means that you have extra fluid in the legs, and that's a sign that the veins were under higher pressure. That higher pressure could be from vein insufficiency, it could be from right-sided heart failure, but by far and away, the most common cause is vein insufficiency here. Now, I'm always asked by my patients, Doc, what caused this in the first place? Well, we don't know all the answers, but we know many things predispose people to developing venous insufficiency. Number one, occupations where you stand up most of the time, nursing, barbers, hairstylists, teachers. These are the people who are on their feet all the time, and they're fighting gravity most in that measure. People who are transcribers, who sit and they're upright, still sitting, and they don't move their legs very much. We know that they're more at risk. We know that women who've had multiple births are more at risk because inside the uterus with the fetus, the placenta and the baby actually can compress the vena cava and obstruct some of the blood flow during pregnancy. That exposes the veins to higher pressures. With that higher pressure, the vein dilates, the valves start not functioning as well, and that causes a problem. And so all of these are factors that we take into account. And of course, there's one factor that's not always so popular to speak about, but it's called genetics. And genetics matter. Okay, if others in your family have developed vein insufficiency, you're more apt to get it. And those we don't have yet all the explanations on a mechanistic explanation there, but we do know that this does tend to run more in certain families. How big is this problem? Well, estimates run all the way from 20 million up to 50 million people have some degree of vein insufficiency. Now, I've just mentioned to start with how we treat these in terms of conservatively. Now, historically, if one needed to go more than just a conservative treatment, then surgeons would actually remove the vein. It was called vein stripping. By and large, that is not used anymore in today's world. Occasionally, one may see a case where a vein is stripped, but that is generally frowned upon in today's world, as there are better, less invasive treatments for treating a large vein insufficiency that is symptomatic. I like to divide the treatments that are presently available into two basic classes. Class one is the use of heat. And with heat, what we do is we scar down these superficial veins, which are working against you. They're not only not helping your body do what the veins were designed to do, but they're creating a whole new conduit back down to the leg, making the other veins work much, much harder. And so one way that we can shut a vein down is to use heat. And the two mechanisms that have historically been used to create heat are a laser or radio frequency catheters. Both of these, though, have one thing in common. They do this, the end result is because of heat, and that heat scars down the superficial vein. Now, to do this, in order to not burn tissues around the vein, we must inject fluid around the vein. And this fluid is called tumescent. Tumescent has buffers in it. It's fluid to absorb any heat that may be there to not injure surrounding structures. And it also has a medicine which can somewhat numb the area that we're treating. Now, the other group of therapies are not heat-based. Cool therapies, if you would. And we have several of those. We have super glue. And with super glue, actually, this is called Varathena. With super glue, we actually put a catheter into the vein, put little drops of super glue, if you would, and compress, and that vein is glued shut. This is a very effective measure which has been used, it tends to result in very good sealing of veins. Another of the non-heat therapies, and one that I'm particularly fond of, is foam. Foam, which includes a medicine called polidocanol, which is an irritant to the vein and helps the vein scar. Now, this foam has much the same consistency as shaving cream. And with this foam, we actually access a vein, and we inject it, and we control where the foam goes by looking at it under ultrasound. And we then make sure this stays within the vein, and that it goes to exactly the spots that we want. Now, what I like about foam is foam not only goes into the main superficial vein, but it goes into the venous varicosities, and it usually scores those down as well. Now, often that makes the venous varicosities completely disappear. But even if it does not make them completely disappear, once it shuts them down, it would allow us in the future, even if they're unsightly, to simply do what's called stab phlebectomy. And then you could take a leg that had big, huge, very, very noticeable, very ugly veins and convert it into a leg where you could not even tell that there was a venous varicosity before. And then finally, there are a series of treatments where we can combine injury to the vein coupled with foam or coupled with another substance which may indeed affect scoring of the vein. But all of these have one thing in common. They do not use heat. Now, the advantage of the therapies that do not use heat, you do not have to inject tumescent. And there's also less risk of injuring nerves. But each of these therapies are effective. And we often choose these therapies on a person-by-person basis based on risk profile and what we're trying to accomplish. Nonetheless, as someone who not only administers care, but has had one of his veins treated, I can tell you that these can be remarkable treatments that can alleviate a lot of pain, particularly in people whose occupations require that they stand a lot on their feet.
Dr. Walker, talk about spider veins. Is that something more than just a cosmetic thing?
As we look at spider veins and we see spider veins, that would fall into a classification that we would call CEAP-1, C-E-A-P, which is a system that we use. CEAP-1 is a lower classification. Typically, that would not be covered by insurances for treatment with invasive treatments. But of course, it would be covered to do the conservative therapies we've mentioned before, like stockings and exercise, et cetera. However, the diagnosis of vein insufficiency is not made by physical exam. It is made by using ultrasound applied from the outside of the body. This is if, for fishermen, it's like a depth finder on a boat. But ultrasound goes down and it bounces off, and we're looking at the vein. And when we look at the vein, we can see, is blood flowing in the right direction or is it going in the wrong direction? That's what vein insufficiency is. And that's how we make the diagnosis. When we see spider veins, or we see telangiectasias, which are just a little bit bigger than spider veins, often, in fact, usually, those people have more than just those. Usually, that is a cutaneous sign of a much bigger problem deeper down. That is why the treatment for spider veins, often people go in and a laser treatment just of the skin makes those go away. But if you speak to women who've had those treatments, they'll tell you they often come back. Well, the reason they come back is they haven't treated the basic problem. If you have an insufficient vein below that, the first treatment is to treat that. And then if you treat that, and then if you laser these, they will not come back because there's nothing feeding that area of dilated blood vessel. So these, if we're just looking physical examination and a SEEP classification, would fall as SEEP 1. SEEP 0 is a completely normal leg. You see nothing. SEEP 1 are spider veins or telangiectasia. SEEP 2 are when we see the big varicose veins. SEEP 3 is when we push with our finger against the bone on our lower leg and it leaves a big dent. That's edema. That's SEEP 3. SEEP 4 has two stages. Stage A, 4A, is when you look at the lower leg and it's very discolored. It's red. That's because blood has been sitting in that vein, and blood cells that we call macrophages pick up some of the blood, and there's iron in that blood. That's a hemoglobin has iron in it. And that's sort of an internal tattoo, if you would. It's tattooing your leg with iron. And that's why the lower leg turns a darker color. Some people say, yeah, I get more sun there. That's not sun when you're seeing that. It's just in that lower extremity. That's hemoglobin that's being deposited into the skin. Now, this process is irritating and can ultimately result in scarring down of that skin. In fact, some people call it the champagne glass sign. And that's SEEP-4B. SEEP 5 is a healed ulcer, and SEEP 6 is an active ulcer. Now, venous ulcers usually occur right at the level of the ankle or slightly above. And these can be, as I've mentioned earlier, debilitating. They're very, very important healthcare problems because if they get infected, they can even lead to leg loss. And you can imagine a first barrier against infection in our body is our skin. And so when we have big open wounds and germs can get in there, that can be problematic, not to mention the fact these may hurt and they're unsightly and they're typically big problems. But as we go up the SEEP classification from 0 to 6, we have, you know, increasing risk. And that's why this classification is so helpful as we look at patients. And then there's a second classification, which is called VCSS. And that looks at the symptoms a patient has had. Now, when we marry these two together, it helps us know what we have to consider in a patient. For instance, we're going to clearly be much more aggressive in a patient who has a big venous ulcer than someone who has just simply a telangiectasia or a spider vein or a reticular vein. So we use this to help guide our therapies. But in today's world, there's no reason to really suffer from vein disease. Now, I'm often asked, well, doc, if I destroy that vein, isn't it going to lessen my circulation? And that answer is no, not at all. We have four more veins than our body needs. God's given us a lot more veins than we need. But here's the issue. Those veins need to be working for us, not against us. And the purpose of a vein is to carry blood back to the heart. When that vein is taking some of the blood that's being carried back to the heart via the deep system, and it's running it right back down to the leg, it is not helping us. It is hurting us. Another question I've been asked is, if I remove that vein, won't it take away options if I need heart bypass? And the answer is, well, they do like to use veins, but insufficient veins make terrible bypass grafts. And often those go down as soon as they're placed by the surgeon. That's one of the reasons those often fail. So the answer to that is no. You know, it really does not take that away. We try to always just treat the portion of the vein that is most insufficient. There are books written about vein insufficiency, but unfortunately, this just hasn't caught on so much where people look for this. For instance, the most common treatment that people get for vein insufficiency, they see their doctor and they put them on Lasix, or they use some other diuretic. They want to get rid of fluid. Well, there is fluid buildup in the legs, for sure, when there's vein insufficiency. But often the intravascular volume, the volume you need to get blood to your brain and to your and out to your heart and to your legs, may be normal or it might even be low. And as you give these diuretics, you may be hurting people. So the first test when someone has leg swelling is to assess, is there vein insufficiency? And that is done with a vein ultrasound. But here's a problem, and this is a very big problem for audiences listening to this. The overwhelming majority of vein studies do not look for vein insufficiency. The vein study is done, and the report that comes back is either there is clot or no clot. Well, clot or no clot is not the answer here. If there's clot, that's important to know, because that can, of course, affect venous return. If there's clot, blood can't go through the clot. But vein insufficiency is far more common. And so you need to know clot, but you need to also know vein insufficiency. And that requires a better test. That requires ultrasound with the patient upright so that we can see which way the blood is going. Overwhelming majority of vein studies are performed with the patient lying flat. Well, if it's performed like that, you will not know if there's insufficiency. Now, failing to make this diagnosis, in my opinion, is a problem. It's a problem because, A, many people are suffering from symptoms that could be alleviated. Secondly, many people get wrong therapies because of it. Many times these patients are treated as cellulitis with antibiotics, or they're treated with diuretics, as I've mentioned before, thinking that it's just fluid, that's what we have to take care of. And the bigger diagnosis is missed, and it misses an opportunity to start conservative measures like weight loss, exercise, calf pump exercises, which may stop the venous insufficiency from becoming worse in the first place.
That's interesting. You mentioned the study where you do the patients upright. Are they on a table or do you have them stand there? How does that work? That's really interesting.
Can be done either way, but the idea is gravity has to be affecting that vein. And so certainly because of gravity, if we spill a glass of water on the floor, it's never going to go to the ceiling. Okay, and well, that's what we're asking blood to do when it's in the veins. We're asking it to go from the floor to the ceiling, and that's why we need the visotergo. That's why we need the negative pressure in the chest and the relaxation of the heart. That's why we need the calf pump exercise and the venous valves working in concert to slowly move blood up. And I really left out one other area, and I don't mean to leave it out. It's a lesser flow area, but it's the lymph channels. So when blood goes from the arteries through the capillaries, it's picked up in two forms of liquid. One is liquid with red blood cells. That's our venous liquid. And then other is some of the liquid that had made it there that doesn't have red blood cells, and that's called lymph. And if you've ever scraped yourself, you see what lymph is. It's just that straw-colored fluid that comes out of a scrape. Now, that comes back through lymph nodes and then ultimately empties into something called the lymphatic, the thoracic duct, or lymphatic duct, some people will call it. And that then ultimately comes back and dumps into the left subclavian vein, the vein up here in the chest. And again, it then mixes with the blood and is circulated again. So the lymph can also cause swelling in the legs. And so often I hear people say, this is just lymphedema. Rarely is it just lymphedema. Overwhelming majority of cases in the United States of a swollen leg is venous edema. Now that in people who have cancer in the United States, we may have some lymphedema component. But the most common cause of lymphedema in the United States is chronic venous insufficiency and chronic elevated venous pressures. That's the most common cause. Now, in some parts of tropical countries, there are roundworms or other things that can get into the lymph channels and block them. One of them, most common, is called filariasis. It's one form of worm. But we do not have those in the United States. Those are, again, things that come from tropical countries. So most of the time, when we see a swollen leg, the first thing we should say, is this coming from vein problem, yes or no? And if that answer is yes, what is that vein problem? Is the vein problem that there's an obstruction higher up? We'll talk about that in another series about obstruction higher up. Or is it coming from clot? Is there a clot stopping the flow? Or is it that the valves are not good? Or is it lymphedema? Is it coming from this higher pressure because the lymph channels have been exposed to issues? But we backtrack and we look at each of those things. And that's why I'm saying many doctors see advanced SEEP skin changes, as we mentioned before. But what do they do with them? Well, they get a vein study. The vein study comes back as either normal, but it doesn't say clot or no clot. It says normal if there's no clot. And they think, it's all okay, but it's not. And that's 99% of vein studies performed in the United States. So the other thing one must understand, and one of the reasons I wanted to speak about this with you, is I want patients to understand someone being told, hey, your vein study was normal, doesn't mean it was really normal. It means you didn't have clot. And that's all they look for. And perhaps a more in-depth study should have been done.
Wow, this is a very detailed and interesting background to varicose veins. I think this is where we're going to end the first episode. Patients out there, that if you're listening to this and you like this kind of content, I would ask you to subscribe and follow us on the various podcast portals and also on YouTube. I really appreciate everyone tuning in for this episode, and we will see you next week with a deeper dive into this topic. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening, and please subscribe, like, and share this podcast with your friends and family. Join us next week for new topics and answers with Dr. Craig Walker and Terry Roberts on Cardiovascular Matters.